Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
So we are continuing in the book of Exodus. And unless I am mistaken, we were in Exodus 7, starting at verse 14. I believe 2 weeks ago, we got all the way through Moses throwing Aaron's rod down and it became a snake. And then the Egyptian magicians did the same thing. And then Aaron's snake ate the other snakes and became a rod again. And that got us talking about the Ark of the Covenant and the elements that were in the Ark. And I think that's where we left off. Yes? So then we did not get to the first real plague. That was the first sign. The snake trick, for lack of a better word, was the first sign that God did in Pharaoh's court in order for Pharaoh to know that Moses was dealing with a God who was actually powerful and able to do the miraculous. But it was not really genuinely a plague. Nobody was really harmed by it. And so tonight we get to the first of the plagues. Now, I've brought a lot of different notes tonight. I don't typically use a lot of notes, but in this instance, I have bits of different commentaries and encyclopedias and such that I think are going to be helpful. Plus, you know that I operate on the theory that there are a few things that are more fun than listening to Jim read. Second only, really, to listening to Jim speak of himself in the third person. The English majors all enjoyed that. The Egyptians, says John Davis in his book Moses and the Gods of Egypt. He says, the Egyptians considered sacred the lion, the ox, the ram, the wolf, the dog, the cat, the ibis, the vulture, the falcon, the hippopotamus, the crocodile, the cobra, the dolphin, different varieties of fish, trees and small animals, including the frog, the scarab, locusts, and other insects. In addition to these were anthropomorphic gods, men in the prime of their life, such as Amun and Aten and Osiris. The point of this being, the reason I wanted to bring that quote out right at the top, is that you have to know that the Egyptians had a whole pantheon of gods. They had gods for everything. But as we go through this series of plagues, they're not random plagues. They're not just God showing off in a random fashion. He's actually pushing at the Egyptian gods. He's mocking the Egyptian gods. And really that's happening in two ways. One is, since as I just read, the Egyptians felt that the frogs were a direct descendant of a frog-type god, and therefore they in many ways idolized frogs. You may, if you've looked at Egyptian history and hieroglyphs, think of how often you've seen headdress, headgear that has frogs on it. So the frog was a symbol of a great many things, including the Nile itself. The Nile was considered the source of life. I mean, you're living in a desert area and you've got a source of water, so it's a source of life. So they worshiped the Nile, they worshiped the frogs that were in the Nile. And so a plague of frogs was God's way of saying, number one, I can mess with your God. And number two, your God doesn't seem to be helping you. If your God is real, if your God is genuine, if the frog God is any real help to you, considering that you've spent all these years worshiping the frog God, then why can't the frog God help you from a plague of frogs? And so there's this series of God making particular plagues speak about particular gods in the wide pantheon of gods that they worshiped. I think that is a great deal of the reason that God began the whole conversation with Moses at the burning bush by identifying himself by the name I Am. I've emphasized this several times through this study, that God is really saying, by identifying himself as I Am that I Am, it's another way of saying, and other gods are not. I am the God that is, all these other gods don't exist. He's giving them a tremendous object lesson as he messes with all of their gods. Which, of course, culminates in him giving them 3 days of darkness, because one of the leading gods that all ancient religions seem to spring from is sun worship. And that cycle of the sun, and at night the death of the sun, or the rebirth of the sun in the morning, and of course all of the harvest feasts and festivals that are built around the return of the sun and the longer days. And so God's going to end up even blotting out that God for 3 days and saying, okay, so now where's your sun God? And then finally culminating in the death of the firstborn. Like, okay, you've got all these gods. You've got so many gods. Where are they if I want to take your loved ones? Where are they if I want to take the next generation of the leaders of Egypt, the firstborn? What if I take them all so that the next generation of supposed leadership doesn't exist and your gods can't do anything about it? So it is another way that God is not just saying, I am sovereign, which is, I am the God that is. I'm the only God that is, and therefore we're going to do things my way. And then there's the great demonstration of the sovereignty of the only God that is, saying, I can mess with your concept of every other God. Now, because God doesn't change, because there's no variableness with him, neither shadow of turning, to this very day, he continues to be the only God that is. And I see so many harbingers of bad news in the world and now creeping into America, the once Christian nation, that there are all these other gods being introduced into the world thinking and into the world culture. And because of the internet and satellites and TV and everything else, we're becoming increasingly aware of all the other religions and all the other gods and all the other worship that is going on planet Earth. I think I told you, I don't know if I did, that a couple weeks ago, Megan's humanities class went to the Parthenon in Nashville. And they needed someone to drive, a couple of the kids who didn't have cars. And so I said, I'll drive. Sure, I'll go. I've never been to the Parthenon. I knew it existed. Never really gone in and walked around the park. Beautiful park, very nice park. Never been to the Parthenon and certainly never been in it. And so as part of a college classroom, you know, lecture series that's going to go talk about Greek gods, we walked into the Parthenon. Have you all been there?
Nope.
Yeah. There is an enormous, is it fair to say enormous?
Oh, yeah.
There is an enormous gold-plated statue of Athena standing in the Parthenon. And it's not, when I say enormous, I don't mean like, wow, that's big. I mean, like, you walk in the room and you're taken aback by it, by how big and how gold and how gigantic and how expensive this must have been in an exact replica of what the Parthenon in Greece was prior to the earthquake. And you walk in and you get this real sense where if that room were full of priests and musicians and smoke and incense, you can see why people would have walked into that place and gotten down in front of that idol.
That's a scaled-down version up there, too.
Of the original?
Yeah,
really? It's breathtaking. I walked in and it kind of took me aback. I didn't know what to expect. We're walking through the downstairs area, and there's pictures and little displays and Egyptian stuff, and I'm thinking, this is really interesting. All this Greek stuff, oh, very cool. Oh, there's a new display going up. You go upstairs, and you turn the corner, and you're in the presence, yeah, boom, you're in the presence of this gigantic golden idol. And suddenly, all of those biblical warnings of God saying, you make these idols, and you hew them out of wood, and you plate them with gold and silver, and you have to nail them to the floor in order to make them stand up, and they can't speak, and they can't help you, and they can't do anything, and yet you bow yourself down to them. And the whole, you will not make any graven image command was ringing loudly in my head as I walked through that room and thought, who decided this was a good idea? Under the guise of a museum, and I love museums. When I lived in San Francisco, I spent a lot of time in Golden Gate Park going to the museums. Love museums. But turn that corner and it went from being a museum to actually being the home of a gigantic golden idol. It was a temple to a golden god. And then I thought, well, what is worship then? Let's talk about worship of a golden god. Okay, people weren't bowing down in front of it, but they had all these music stands and chairs in front of it where you can tell they've had concerts in front of it. And then everybody who goes to see the golden god has to pay to go see it, right? And since worship is a contraction of two old English words, worth-ship, you demonstrate worth, and by demonstrating worth, you are worshiping whatever it is you're giving that money to, that you're spending that time on, demonstrating the worth of it. So it's this parade of people coming through the door, spending their money to go stand in front of the golden idol. I'm just telling you, it was creepy. That's all I'm saying. I stood there quite uncomfortable with the whole thing, and I tried to listen to the hired tour guide who was telling the history and the background of all of it, and I was walking around with Meg's video camera taking pictures of all of it, and then as soon as I thought I had adequate pictures, I just said, yeah, I'll be out front. You know, I'll be over there if you need me, because I found it really, really disconcerting, because I walked in there right in the midst of teaching this very thing where God is saying, I'm the God, I'm the only God, and there are no other gods. And when you hear that stuff, people have a tendency to think, well, that was then. That was those people back then. They were very superstitious back then. But what's the fastest growing religion in Europe right now?
Islam.
Does Islam follow Yahweh? No. They're following a completely different God who denies the God of the Bible.
Not according to George Bush. According to George Bush, it's the same God.
According to George Bush, it's the same God.
Yeah.
According to the Bible, it's a different God, but it's spreading like wild and making huge inroads into Europe and into America. If that's a different God, then we're still talking about the reality that as long as there's human beings, there is the desire to worship something. And if they don't worship the real God, the only God that is, they're still going to worship something because they want there to be something bigger than themselves to give their lives meaning. And it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, a form of Athena. It doesn't matter whether it's there is one God, Allah is his name, Muhammad is his prophet. It doesn't matter if it's a pop star, if it's hanging on every word that Britney Spears says and worrying if she gets her kids back. People are going to worship something. So don't be so egocentric. Don't be so grand in your own mind as to think, well, we're better now. We're past all that. We've moved past that. It's just those ancients that worshiped foreign gods. Foreign gods are alive and well and running rampant on planet Earth. Yes, ma'am.
Well, you mentioned that you didn't know who decided this. This was from the 100-year centennial celebration.
Right.
Well, the rise of classicism in this university community and their worship of secular humanism is where this all came from.
Mm-hmm.
So it is quite offensive to what should have been a theological school right across the street, Vanderbilt, mm-hmm. protecting the gate, you know, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's no surprise that we have classical architecture in Nashville.
Absolutely. And Vanderbilt has gone on to become one of the most liberal schools in the world.
They have female homosexual as their...
The leading New Testament professor says that Jesus didn't die on the cross and was probably eaten by dogs. So there you go. That was just in the paper a couple of years ago. Am I alone here?
Yeah.
No, I brought it here and read it. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so if God is the only God that exists,
right,
then there are forces of evil, though, that also mm-hmm. exist. Mm-hmm. They're just not gods.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're talking about forces of evil, then you're talking about fallen angels, right? You're talking about Daemon, you're talking about Satan and his minions. Are they gods? No. But what was the key element in Satan's fall?
Pride.
Yeah, pride and the desire for worship. I will set up my throne in the place of the north. I will be worshipped as God. And so you can naturally then understand that Satan and his minions are not going to appear as devils with red tails and pitchforks. Satan said he was beautiful, you know, and that his pipes and his tabrets were built into him from the day he was created until evil was found in him. And so Paul writes that Satan was an angel of light, and so it's no surprise then that his ministers come as angels of light. And so, of course, they're going to try to look like something valuable and worthwhile, and they're going to desire worship. But they are not gods. Angels, fallen angels, to begin with, have no actual power. They certainly are not omniscient, they are not benevolent, and they don't have the power to create. And so when you put all that together, they are opposing God as being the only God. They're doing everything they can to deceive people into worshiping anything other than the real God. And I think that's, again, why God then shows that as the real God, as the only God, he can mess with all those other gods, and they can't help. I mean, if those other gods were powerful and benevolent, wouldn't they have helped? If there was a real locust god, wouldn't they, during the locust plague, have stopped the locusts? Well, they don't. Why? Because they have no power. They don't exist. If they are anything, they are evil forces that are not benevolent and won't help when you need help. So why are you worshiping them? Right? So we're going to start with the Nile being turned to blood. Then the Lord said to Moses, verse 14 of chapter 7 of Exodus, then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to water. Station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile, and you shall take in your hand the staff that was turned into a serpent. So which staff is that? Aaron's rod. Aaron's staff. And you will say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, capital L-O-R-D, that's the proper name. So he's saying, say to him, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews. We're identifying which God now. Since Pharaoh naturally thinks in terms of many, many gods, it's necessary to identify which God it is that's active at this moment. So go and say to him that Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, sent me unto you, saying, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. And behold, you have not listened up until now. Thus says the Lord, by this you shall know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will strike the water that is in the Nile with the staff that is in my hand, and it shall be turned to blood. And the fish that are in the Nile will die, and the Nile will become foul, and the Egyptians will find difficulty in drinking water from the Nile. Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, take your staff. Now we know again, this is Aaron's staff. Again, you're going to see this consistently. We talked about it 2 weeks ago. The importance of this staff, which becomes known as the staff, which staff ends up resurrecting later and ending up in the Ark of the Covenant. Take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over the rivers, over the streams, over their pools, and over all their reservoirs of water, that they may become blood. And there shall be blood throughout all of the land of Egypt, both in the vessels of wood and in the vessels of stone. So Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord had commanded. And he lifted up the staff, and he struck the water that was in the Nile in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, and all of the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood. And the fish that were in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul, so that the Egyptians could not drink the water of the Nile, and the blood was through all the land of Egypt. Now, a sane man at this point would have said, we better let those people go. Because at this point, we have nothing to drink. The whole of Egypt, it says, this translation says foul. The King James says it stunk, as you might imagine. Blood gets old fast and it begins to stink. Plus, you've got all the dead fish washing up on shore. By the way, the dead fish would have included dead frogs, would they not have? And since the Nile was the main house and home and dwelling of all the frogs, this would have killed all the frogs too, which makes the later plague of frogs all the more miraculous and amazing, because at this moment, all the frogs are dying in the Nile. So all the pools, the streams, everywhere, wherever the water was, it was all turning to blood. So what does Pharaoh do? Like I said, a sane man would have said, yeah, you're right, you make a good point. We should probably let you go. Instead, the magicians, verse 22, of Egypt did the same with their secret arts, and Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them. I want to know how that worked out. Because if all the water is blood, where did they get the more water? And then, is it really impressive if all the water in Egypt is blood, if you take like a glass of water and go, hey, ta-da, blood? What they should have done, had they had any power, was turn the blood into water. That would have been impressive. But the thinking here was, and it's the common thinking today among critics, and I've mentioned this before, is that they think that just because they can mimic the acts of God, that somehow proves that the acts of God were not genuine. I saw a magician on TV one time walk across a swimming pool. But everybody knew it was a magic trick. Nobody actually thought the guy walked on water. But the impression they gave was, oh, look, he walked on water. That's like the thing Jesus did. Except that Jesus walked across a stormy sea from shore to shore. And just because a guy with a cheap trick walks across a pool, it does not negate that Jesus miraculously walked across the Sea of Galilee. Understand what I'm saying? So the thinking of the Egyptians here was, well, sure, you made all the water in Egypt blood, but watch, the magicians will do a similar trick. So somehow that's supposed to negate the fact that you did it? Or that Moses was just doing an aggrandized trick? That Moses was doing it under his own power because, look, even the magicians can do it? But what the magicians did, like I said, was a cheap imitation. They're going to do the same thing later with the frogs. My thinking is, if you have an absolute plague of frogs, where frogs are everywhere, and they're in your kneading bowls, and they're in your ovens, and they're in your bed, and they're in your clothes, is it impressive when a magician goes, hey, look, more frogs? That does not make anybody go, yes, yes. How about you make the frogs go away? That'd be a good trick. So here's the first plague that we're seeing. God is turning the Nile, the source of life, the source of water, and the river that they worshiped, he's turning it into a place of death. They saw it as the source of life, so God says, watch me mess with your source of life and turn it into a river of death. This plague was an affront to many of the greatest of the Egyptian gods. The great god, it's Khnum in English letters. I'm going to go with Khnum. He was the guardian of the Nile River, and he is usually represented as a human being with a ram's head. There was also Hapi, Hapi or Hapi, was known as the spirit of the Nile, and he was its dynamic essence. This Hapi, Hapi, which I guess we could pronounce as happy if we wanted to, was the god of the annual Nile inundation. Epithets for Hapi describe him as being the lord of the fishes and the birds and the marshes. So was he any help at this moment?
I don't see any life going through that river anymore.
No, no. So I really do think that this is God making it very obvious that he can mess with these gods and that he can take a god that is a god of life and make it a god of death, and that that god of life is so non-existent and so unpowerful that he can't stop the hand of the real God. He can't make life come where God is making death. The very position of this Hapi or Happy or made it certain that he would become successful as a deity. The entire country looked to the Nile as its source of all wealth and provender, so that the deity which presided over it rapidly rose in public estimation, because after all, the ships would sail up and down the Nile, all the products that came in came up and down the Nile, their fish and food came out of the Nile, their water came out of the Nile. Even in order to build, they had to have water to put with the dirt and the straw to make the mud, to make the bricks. Everything they did revolved around the Nile. Thus, the god of the Nile quickly became identified with the greater and more outstanding figures in early Egyptian mythology. He thus became a partner with the great original gods who had created the world and finally came to be regarded as the maker and the molder of everything within the universe. Now think about that. If there is a god of the Nile who has a very early appearance in Egyptian history and mythology, and he has made his way into the upper strata of the Egyptian gods because he is equated with the Nile, which is the source of life and trade and everything they do, then as they add to the mythology of that god, they finally equate him with the god who made the universe. Well, he's not the god that made the universe, because so far through the book of Genesis and Exodus, one of the key ways that God has been identified, that Yahweh has been identified, is the God who made heaven and earth, right? That's a real important nomenclature, the God who made heaven and earth. And so, of course, the first Egyptian god he's going to mess with is the one that the Egyptians think made the universe. Not only is he powerless, but he can't help you. The God of the Hebrews can, at any time he wants, turn the source of life into a source of death. And your God is no help to you. We find him credited with the attributes of the god Nu, the primeval water mass, and this, in effect, made him the father of Ra, who had emerged from that element. So this Hapi, the god of the Nile River, indeed stood in more immediate relationship to the Egyptians than almost any other god in their pantheon. Without the sun, Egypt would have been plunged into darkness. But without the Nile, every living creature within its borders would assuredly have perished. That's from a writer named Spence in the book Ancient Egyptian Myths and Legends. And so we have to understand when we read these stories that it's much more than Moses just saying, hey, watch, I'll do a trick. I'll turn the Nile into blood. He was making a very profound statement at that moment about the God that is and the chief God of the Nile, the chief God of Egypt, who was no help to them when the real God decided to mess with them. Understand? This is a demonstration of God's sovereignty over every other god. One of the greatest gods of Egypt was Osiris, the god of the underworld, and the Egyptians believed that the Nile was his actual bloodstream. And so during this first plague, the Egyptians would have to wonder, where was the hippopotamus goddess of the river, whose name was Taret? I mean, she lived in the Nile River. Where was she in the midst of all this? And where was Nu, the god of life, who lived in the Nile? And where was this Hapi, the source of all life, when God made the Nile the source of death? God is making it real clear that the God that is the God that needs to be worshipped. So Pharaoh turned and went into his house, with no concern even for all this. Verse 24 then says, so all the Egyptians dug around the Nile for water to drink, looking for the underground springs or anything that fed the river or flowed off it, for they could not drink the water of the Nile. 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. Now, because it's a river and it's flowing, we know that eventually the blood part washed out and the water came back in, because one of the things that Moses is going to say later during the plague of frogs is that he's going to tell Pharaoh that the frogs are going to be confined to the Nile. So the Nile becomes a place, a source of life for the frogs again. So we know that the blood eventually washes out. And I think that's the significance of, and 7 days passed after the Lord struck the Nile, that there was probably 7 days of everything being blood in Egypt. So there was a great deal of thirst and people digging in the ground around the Nile, searching for water, but eventually it washed out. Which then takes us to chapter 8. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite your whole territory with frogs. There's an interesting if in that sentence. If you refuse to let them go, I'm going to do this. Did God know that Pharaoh was going to refuse?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. He said it from the very beginning. I will harden his heart. He won't let them go. I'm going to kill his firstborn. All of that was said to Moses right away. And yet God holds out the if you do not do this, I'm going to punish you. Now, this gets into a bit of real difficult theology for us to grasp. Did God know what Pharaoh was going to do? Did God take responsibility for what Pharaoh was going to do? Yeah, he said, I will harden his heart. I will harden his heart so that he will not let you go, and then I'm going to kill the firstborn. I'm going to bring you out with a mighty hand so that my name is going to be published far and wide. I'm going to get glory to myself in the way that I treat the Egyptians and deliver my people. So God knew what he was going to do, and God took responsibility for what he was going to do. Did he then anyway say, and if you resist me, which you're going to do, but if you resist me, I'm going to hold you accountable and punish you for it?
Yep.
See, those are all part of the story, aren't they? Now, did I misread any part of that? Because all of those elements are in the narrative. God saying, I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart. He's not going to let you go. I'm going to kill his firstborn. I'm going to deliver you. I'm going to make my name great. So then he turns around and says to Pharaoh, now, if you don't let them go, which I know you're not going to, and I'm going to harden your heart so you don't, but if you don't, I'm going to punish you. Didn't God start right off with, I'm going to kill the firstborn? Sure. He's going to continue hardening Pharaoh's heart throughout this process until he kills the firstborn, and the whole time he's going to blame Pharaoh for it. Pharaoh's the one who's going to get the punishment. The Egyptians are going to get the punishment. The firstborn are going to get the punishment. The army of Pharaoh is going to get drowned in the Red Sea. God is going to punish them for things that God said they were going to do anyway by God's own sovereign hand. Did I misread anything yet?
Nope.
No. Does God change?
See,
this is one of those places that people struggle so hard when Paul gets into Romans 9 and says, you will say to me then, how can he yet find fault, seeing as no one has resisted his will? So there's a universal statement there. No one has resisted the will of God. And then he says, but if no one's resisted the will of God, if they've only done what God determined they were going to do, how can he fault them? How can he judge them? How can he hold them accountable if they only did what he determined they'd do? That's a really hard theological question, isn't it? Except that it's exactly the way God works all the way back here with Pharaoh. And so that's why Paul goes to Pharaoh in Romans 9, and uses Pharaoh as his example, and says, God said to Pharaoh, I raised you up for this very purpose. And then God hardens his heart, and then God delivers his own people. So the point is, I got an interesting email this week from a woman that I'm constructing a response to right now, where she's dealing with this very question. How is that fair? How can God be like that and also be considered a kind, loving, gracious, righteous judge? How is that right? And my response to her is going to be, it doesn't matter whether we consider what God does right or just or fair. The question is this what he's like? And if this is what he's like, then your job is just to get in line with that. It's the only God you find in the Bible. And if you reject the God of the Bible because you don't like the way he is, he's going to stay that way anyway, because that's exactly how he is. Understand me? It's sad to watch humans in their ego buck against and rebel against a God who has revealed himself so completely and said, this is exactly what I'm like. This is how I act. This is what I do. This is how I do it. And then people say, well, I don't like that God.
Do they have a better option?
Yeah, precisely right. So what are your other options? Okay, well, then I'm going to go to one of those other gods that isn't a god. And I'm going to go worship one of those because I don't like your god. And so they go create a god of their imagination and worship him. But is he the real God? No. As long as there's been a Bible, ever since Moses sat down and put quill to paper or quill to papyrus or whatever in the world he wrote on, as soon as Moses sat down and started writing what we call the Pentateuch, he started describing God only one way. And all the way through the whole rest of the Bible, he's described exactly that way. Did Job deserve anything that happened to him?
No.
Isn't that the whole debate of the book of Job? His three fair-weather friends come and argue with him for the whole middle three quarters of the book, saying to him, Job, look, you better just admit you did something wrong. And he just keeps saying, but I didn't. It's just God being God. This is how God works. And at the end of the book of Job, God comes and says to the three fair weather friends, that it's going to have to be Job who's going to have to sacrifice for them. They did not speak that which was right about me. And what they said was simply, God needs to be fair according to our standards. It would be unfair of God to treat you this way, Job. So they argued for a fairer version of God. And God says, I'm angry at them because they didn't speak that which is right of me. And Job, who continued to maintain his integrity and said, I didn't do anything to bring this on. This serves God's purpose somehow. God did this because he's God. And though he slays me, yet I will trust him. God said, that's the right answer. So now you better sacrifice for your friends because they don't know what they're talking about. So again, it's consistent all the way through the scripture. God says, this is what I'm like. And he is perfectly willing and perfectly capable of judging people he has not saved. Is that fair? It's the only God you find in the Bible. Because now we're kind of stuck with that, aren't we? So let's do it this way. I'll make it really easy. I'll break it down to brass tacks. We'll talk to Karen. Hi, Karen. Okay. Yeah, this is really easy. Are you saved?
Yes.
Okay. Who saved you?
God.
Okay. Was that an accident or did he do it on purpose? Okay. Does everybody get saved?
No.
Does anybody ever go to hell?
Yes.
Does anybody ever fall under God's judgment?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so he saved you on purpose, and they're going to fall under his judgment. Why didn't he save them then?
He didn't tell me.
He didn't tell you. It obviously served his purpose, right? I mean, if he saved you to serve his purpose, he didn't save them to serve his purpose. Our God is in the heavens. He does whatever he pleases. And so it served his purpose to save you. It served his purpose not to save them. Does that, the fact that he saved you and was gracious to you and kind to you, does that in any way negate the judgment he's going to give them?
Yeah.
No. That's the way God's always, always been. And we understand it when we put it in those kind of simple terms. But when we see Pharaoh back here being treated this way, it just does seems so unfair, doesn't it? God says, I'm going to harden his heart, and he's not going to believe you. Now go and say to him, if you don't believe me, I'm going to punish you. But God, you just said he's not going to believe you. Yeah, I know. But go tell him that if he doesn't believe me, I'm going to punish him. Well, he's not going to believe you. Yes, and I'm going to hold him accountable for the fact that he doesn't believe. Same God. That's how he works. So can anybody ever claim ignorance when they stand before the throne of God? Does anybody have any claim that they can make for God? You can't punish me. That's not fair. I didn't know. You didn't treat me right. You didn't tell me. That's what my pastor told me. I was in the wrong church. I grew up in the wrong country. It's like, does anybody have any claim? No, because God starts right out by saying, yeah, I know. Yeah, I knew that. Yeah, I knew that's how it was. And that's my purpose. And I'm going to glorify myself in saving people on purpose. And I'm going to glorify myself in judging people on purpose. And it doesn't matter whether you like that or not. It only matters that that's how God describes himself. Now find any other God in the Bible. Find any other version of the God of the Bible anywhere in the Bible, and then maybe you can make an argument. But if that is consistently the only description you find of Yahweh throughout the Bible, then you're stuck with that God. And whatever that does to your thinking, whatever that does to your theology, whatever that does to your sense of fairness, doesn't matter. Get in line with that God because he's the only God that is. So align yourself with that reality. And then, while you're busy worrying about things like, what about the people who have never heard? What about the pygmies in Borneo? What about the people in the South American jungles who never heard, who never had a chance to hear, who never? Leave them in God's hands. Don't argue with God over things you have no control over. He's the God who does everything according to his own purpose. And by the way, if it's true, as the book of Revelation says, that there's going to be this innumerable crowd around his throne that's going to include people of every kindred, tribe, tongue, and nation, then you can't name a kindred or a tribe or a tongue or a nation that is not going to have saints come out of it. which means even the people in the jungles and the pygmies in Borneo and all the people you're so concerned about, God is able to save even them. For heaven's sake, he got to you, he can get to them. But there are people in America who have had unlimited access to the gospel, and he's not saving them. So he can equally save whoever he wants. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Sometimes I think, when I watch TV religion, I think that sometimes America is a greater religious wasteland than Borneo at this moment. So, I'm sorry, did I get a hoo from somebody? Where that hoo? Hoo. So the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite your whole territory with frogs. If you don't do what I tell you, I'm going to smite you. And you're not going to do it, and I'm going to smite you. And the Nile will swarm with frogs. Well, if the Nile is swarming with frogs, it has to be able to sustain frogs, so it has to have become clean water again, right? Which will come up and go into your house and into your bedroom and on your bed and into your houses of your servants and on your people and into your ovens and into your kneading bowls, your cooking utensils. That's a lot of frogs. Anybody here queasy about frogs? Anybody here kind of, ooh, frog?
Wouldn't want them in my bed.
Wouldn't want them in your bed, yeah. Or in your cooking utensils or in your oven, yeah. When I was a kid, I stepped on a frog, and I was in bare feet. And unfortunately, he was not a big frog, so he squished. Ooh, I know, squishy frog, I know. Well, if there's frogs covering the ground, and they're everywhere, and they're in your house, and they're in your bed, it's impossible not to do the squishy frog thing, you know? So we're not only just talking about a plague of frogs, but they're everywhere. You can't lay down, you can't walk, you can't stand, you can't go anywhere without frogs everywhere. That's going to get real old real fast. So the frogs will come up on your people and on all your servants. I don't even like the preposition on in that sentence.
Oh.
They're going to come up. I'm trying to get you to kind of walk this out for a moment and realize how incredibly creepy this had to be. So the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers, over the streams, over the pools, and make the frogs come up on the land of Egypt. Now that's quite miraculous because, as I said, when it was all blood, everything died. So where is this great multitude of frogs coming from? There's definitely several miracles at work here. So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up, and they covered the land of Egypt. And the magicians, this is just a hysterical verse. I can't help it. When I read the Bible, sometimes you just have to laugh. And the magicians did the same with their secret arts, making frogs come up on the land of Egypt. That's not impressive. If the land is already full of frogs, and there's frogs in your bed, and frogs in your cooking utensils, and there's frogs everywhere, somebody going, watch, frogs. Yeah, that's not impressive. It's like, no, wait, let me make sure I understand. So you made frogs? There's frogs everywhere.
How do you know they're your frogs?
How do we know those are your frogs?
Probably just ask the Pharaoh to turn around for one.
Exactly.
Second.
It's like, close your eyes. Okay, now open your eyes. More frogs, right? Ah. What a bad trick. Impressive trick would have been clear out the frogs. Make the frogs go away. There's a good trick. So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up, and they covered the land of Egypt. The magicians did the same thing. Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, entreat the Lord that he remove the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go that they may sacrifice to the Lord. Does he mean it?
No.
No. This is typical of how human beings work. Anyone who's taken a basic psychology class will tell you that the two primary motivators in human beings is gain pleasure, avoid pain. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a lot of pain going on here. And by the way, since Pharaoh himself was worshipped as a god among his people, this has to be embarrassing for him politically, as his people are coming to him saying, get rid of the frogs. What are you doing? Get rid of the frogs. Help us. Do some of that God stuff you're supposed to have. Help us with the frogs here. So he avoids the pain, calls Moses and Aaron and says, entreat the Lord that he remove the frogs from me and from my people, and I'll let your people go that they may sacrifice to the Lord. And Moses said to Pharaoh, I don't see God telling Moses to say this. So I think this is just Moses tweaking Pharaoh a little bit. This is Moses saying, I'm going to prove to you that this is a miraculous action, so that when it's over, you don't go, well, that could have just been an odd natural disaster that occurred. Suddenly a whole bunch of frogs came up. So he says, the honor is yours, Pharaoh, to tell me, when shall I entreat for you and your servants and your people that the frogs be destroyed from you and your houses and that they be left only in the Nile? In other words, he's saying, I'll tell you what, Pharaoh, just to prove to you where the power lays in this relationship, you want the frogs gone, I'll even let you tell me what time you want the frogs gone. Tell me when you want the frogs gone, and that's when they'll be gone, just to show you where the power in the relationship is. So Pharaoh takes him up on it. Then he said, tomorrow. So he said, may it be according to your word, that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. And the frogs will depart from you and your houses and your servants and your people, and they will be left only in the Nile. It's going to happen tomorrow, just like you said. Then Moses and Aaron went out from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord concerning the frogs, which he had inflicted upon Pharaoh. And the Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died out of the houses and the courts and the fields, and they piled them up in heaps, and the land became foul. So again, the land is stinking. Why is the land stinking again? Death. There's massive death everywhere. What'd the Nile do? Death. What's the second plague do? Death. God keeps pouring out this death thing. Now, can you imagine having to get people out in the streets to shovel up the piles and heaps of dead frogs that are stinking? Can you imagine all of Egypt stinking with the stench of death? So Moses and Aaron went from Pharaoh, and Moses cried to the Lord concerning the frogs. The Lord did according to the word of Moses, and the frogs died, and they piled them in heaps. Verse 15, but when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, see, he avoided the pain, he gained the pleasure. When he saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart. He did not listen to them, as the Lord had said. Moses adds that too. Exactly as the Lord had said. Everything that happens here is exactly as the Lord has said. So let's talk about frogs for a moment. The frog was considered the theophany, or the physical embodiment, of the goddess Heqt, pronounced, I think, Hect, who was the wife of the creator of the world, and she was the goddess of birth. So now do you understand why God went for these two right at the beginning? First he went after the Nile, which was equated with the creator God, and then he went after his wife, the wife of the creator God. She was the wife of the creator of the world. She was the goddess of birth. So what does God make him? Death. Hect was always shown with the head and the body of a frog. Amulets and scarabs worn by Egyptian women to protect them during childbirth often bear the image of Hect for protection. And you see that to this very day, the frog scarabs and emblems and brooches and such. Very popular symbol to this very day in Egypt. Amulets and scarabs worn by Egyptian women to protect them during childbirth would often bear the image of Hect for protection. Hect was believed to assist women in childbirth and considered... And so consider the irony in the statement that the frogs invaded Pharaoh's bedroom and would have been jumping into his bed. Frogs were so sacred in Egypt that even the involuntary slaughter of one frog could be punished by death. Imagine the people of the land as they went out to gather the heaps of decaying bodies of the frogs and having to put them into fires and burn them away to keep the stink down. You can only imagine. I mean, don't kill a frog. A frog is sacred. Now, if you want to again say, oh, that's those ancient people and their silly religions and their silly beliefs. Anybody been to India? Anybody seen pictures, movies of India? Yeah. What do they do with the cows?
Oh, my gosh, they run the streets.
The cows run in the streets. Yeah. Why?
Well, because they're sacred.
They're sacred. Yeah, they worship cows.
Apparently.
We eat them at drive-thrus. Yeah, which Tom's like, yeah. Over there, they consider them sacred, and so they just let them wander the streets.
And that's a huge problem between the Muslim and the Hindu there, because the Muslim will butcher
them. Right. The Muslim will butcher them, and the Hindu won't. And when you have cows walking the streets, how shall I put this delicately? You got to watch where you walk.
Oh, well, not just because of the refuse, but because they are quite wild.
Right.
I was walking with a guide, and a heifer literally tried to gore him while we were standing there.
Mm-hmm.
For no reason. It's her street.
Her street. Get out of my street. Yeah, exactly. And so as soon as you start saying, oh, it's those silly old ancients and they're silly worshiping frogs. That is so silly, worshiping frogs. It's no sillier than worshiping cows, which is going on the planet right now. India is still doing these peculiar things that are intrinsic to humans. That's my point. As long as there are humans, there will be people worshiping God knows what.
Well,
but it ain't God.
Pardon me? Animism is on the rise.
Right. Yeah, the worship of all kinds of animal. Yeah. Yes, ma'am, you began to say.
I was just going to say it's so ironic because so many people are starving to death in India.
In India, yeah.
And the food is running wild through the streets.
Right.
You know, it's just sad.
And they're destroying their only source of water, the river that they all go down to bathe in.
The Ganges,
is becoming so polluted between the cows bathing in it and all the cow refuse, and then, you know, all the cities that have built up around the Ganges so that they can get to it every day to wash in it, dump all of their waste into it.
Just from their dead.
And the ashes from their dead are put in it because they believe that carries them into the next world. And then people are bathing in it because it is the water that they worship, and they're all getting sick from it and believing that if they wash in it more, that'll make them well. But in fact, that's what's making them all so sick. So, strange worship, strange religion, human tradition, and the worship of everything but God continues to this day. Let's, again, not become so high-minded as to think, that was those people back then. The command, you will not have any gods before me, and the command, you will not have any graven images, is just as necessary command today as it ever was when Moses wrote it. Because people are people, and they're going to worship something. And if they don't worship the real God, they'll worship something.
Look at the American Indian totem pole, the animals that they worship.
Right.
You know.
I always thought that was very interesting because the totem pole was a series of animals that they worshiped, but then when they would kill those animals, they ate the heart of the animal. And why did they eat the heart of the animal? So that the spirit of that animal would go into them. And then they would worship that animal. So that's really just self-worship. If you worship buffalo, and then you kill a buffalo and eat its heart so that you have the heart and soul of the buffalo in you, and then you worship the buffalo, how humanistic is that worship in the end anyway? It's just a cycle of animism, like
that's,
you said.
Yeah, well, that's kind of odd because the Hindu is the only animist culture that probably doesn't eat that because all the African animists do ingest the creatures, but the Hindus forbid it.
Yep. But that goes a long way back. Eating the flesh of your gods goes a long way back, which takes us right into the whole idea of transubstantiation and how that worked its way into the Christian religion, because so many of the heathen religions believed in eating the flesh of your God. And so the idea of eating the flesh of Christ, drinking his blood, when he could say it in a symbolic fashion, it was very easy for that to get warped into the thinking of, he means continue eating the flesh of your God. So, all right, well, it's getting late, and so we're going to stop there and pick up next week with the plague of insects. And it's just going to continue getting creepier from there. If you thought frogs were bad, he's going to send a biting insect, a biting fly. There's a lot of debate about exactly what the insect would have been, but it's a biting, itching, lice-type fly that is going to, you're already scratching, aren't you? That is going to cover everybody in Egypt until they're all just full of sores and bites and these bugs are everywhere and you can't get away from them. I was walking outside a few weeks ago and there was one of those little clouds of gnats and it just drove me crazy. You know, get out of my face, get out, and gnats. Can you imagine being covered with bugs that are biting you and you can't get away from them, you can't escape them, they're everywhere in Egypt. You can't go indoors, outdoors, anywhere and get away from them. Well, that's the next thing God's going to do to them. And like I keep saying, sane people would have said, oh, okay, let's let these people go. It would take God hardening their hearts in order for them to continue to resist. But I also think at some point, the people on the street would be going, okay, Pharaoh, perhaps as a representative of us, perhaps you could call a stop to this. And in fact, his own ministers are going to reach that point and say to him, why are you doing this? You got to put a stop to this. So the rebellion against him as a God is going to rise up too.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.